The countdown is on. Holiday shopping season is officially here. Uncommon Goods takes the stress out of gifting with thousands of unique, high-quality finds that you won't see anywhere else. But don't wait, because the most meaningful gifts get scooped up fast, and now's the perfect time to cross names off your list. From practical gifts like a cast iron potato baker to unique and interesting gifts for kids like a smartphone-controlled paper airplane, Uncommon Goods has something for everyone that you're not going to find anywhere else. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back a dollar to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've given away over $3.1 million so far. So don't wait. Cross those names off your list before the rush. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/JFK. That's uncommongoods/JFK for 15% off. I don't know about you, but when I need to get into that Curtis LeMay, sitting there watching the autopsy vibe, I look for a cigar that I can rely on. And that's why I love Thompson Cigar. They've been around since 1915, so they know a thing or two about cigars. Whether it's a quick 5-pack for the weekend or joining one of their value clubs, Thompson makes it easy to save while enjoying top-notch cigars. It's like having your own personal humidor with deals that you can't pass up. Visit www.thompsoncigar.com/JFK or use code JFK at checkout for 20% off of your order of $75 or more. Discover why Thompson has been America's humidor since 1915 and join the thousands of satisfied customers who trust Thompson for quality, value, and exceptional service. This episode of Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. In the last episode, we stepped back into the world of Jack Ruby. Not in the basement of the Dallas Police Department, but in the decades that led him there. By the end, one thing was clear. Jack Ruby was suspiciously close with many organized crime figures, and he very likely was running guns to Cuba before Castro took over. If the last episode showed us how Ruby entered the orbit of organized crime, this episode looks at just how deep inside that orbit he may have been. We'll examine Ruby's stint as an FBI informant, his relationship with Louis McWillie, the allegation that he visited mafia boss Santos Traficante in prison, Ruby's ties to Carlos Marcello, and the flurry of long-distance calls Ruby made in the months and weeks before November 22, 1963. Then we'll turn our attention to the stranger-than-fiction role of one of Jack Ruby's psychiatrists, Dr. Louis Jolyon West.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This morning resumed custody the man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a part of it.
The man is Lee Oswald.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? The mission answers, he acted alone.
I'm working.
I'm just a part of it.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. Around the same time as when Robert McEwen said that he interacted with Jack Ruby in March of 1959, Ruby was approached by Dallas FBI agent Charles Flynn about becoming an informant for the FBI. The Bureau believed that Ruby, quote, might have knowledge of the criminal element in Dallas because he was in the nightclub business. Author Lamar Waldron asserts that Ruby likely got permission to be an FBI informant from mafia superiors like Joe Civello and Joe Campisi. The idea was that if he became an informant, Ruby would have extra protection for illegal activities and a way to find out what crimes the FBI was interested in. Ruby contacted the FBI on 8 different occasions between March and October of 1959. After that, the communication stopped. Jack Ruby being an FBI informant for a period of time doesn't necessarily prove anything, but it does raise the question of why the Warren Report failed to mention Ruby's informant status even once. If Jack Ruby did not have close ties to the mob, as the Warren Commission asserted, it becomes harder to explain exactly why he took a trip to Cuba in 1959, shortly after Fidel Castro came to power, to visit an extremely connected friend of his, Louis McWillie. This 1959 Cuba trip to see McWillie is also the root of the allegation that Jack Ruby helped get Santos Traficante released from a Cuban prison. So who exactly was Louis McWillie? Did Ruby really visit him in Cuba? And is there any truth to the Traficante prison visit? Let's start with Jack Ruby's friend, Louis McWillie. McWillie, who was a world-class gambler, came up working for Meyer Lansky in Cuban casinos, where he met Johnny Rosselli in 1938. In the 1940s, McWillie met Ruby when he was working at illegal gambling clubs in Dallas and Fort Worth. After that, McWillie worked at the Traficante-controlled Tropicana and Capri casinos in Cuba. In 1961, Johnny Rosselli reached out to McWillie to give him the trusted role of keeping tabs on Frank Sinatra, who Sam Giancana was worried about getting too close to President Kennedy. McWillie was sent to work in a management position at Sinatra's Cal Neva Lodge on behalf of the Chicago outfit. After monitoring Sinatra until Kennedy cut off ties with him, McWillie then went on to continue his casino career in Las Vegas, working at mob-affiliated places like the Thunderbird. In summary, Louis McWillie worked with Meyer Lansky and Santos Traficante and was then personally asked by Johnny Rosselli to keep an eye on Frank Sinatra at his casino on behalf of Sam Giancana. McWillie indisputably had relationships at the highest echelons of La Cosa Nostra. Most importantly, McWillie acknowledged to the House Select Committee on Assassinations that he was one of Jack Ruby's best friends throughout the 1950s. What about Ruby going to Cuba to supposedly get Traficante out of prison? Did that really happen? Even the Warren Report admitted that Jack Ruby went to Cuba while Traficante was locked up in prison. The report said, quote, "In September 1959, Ruby traveled to Havana as a guest of a close friend and known gambler, Louis J. McWillie. Both Ruby and McWillie state that the trip was purely social." The Warren Report itself avoided the topic of Ruby's ties to organized crime. According to a memo from Warren Commission staff attorneys Leon Hubert and Bert Griffin, rumors that Jack Ruby was involved in illegal activities in Cuba were never even investigated by the commission. Ruby told the FBI in December of 1963 that he visited Louis McWillie in Havana for 8 to 10 days in August of 1959. McWillie was the pit boss at the Traficante-controlled Riviera Casino at the time. McWillie paid for and sent the plane tickets for the Cuba trip to Ruby. But according to the FBI, quote, following Ruby's arrival, he found he did not have a good time as he expected. He was not a gambler, and after several days in Havana with nothing to do, he was glad to return to Dallas. We know from Jack Ruby's background that he was a semi-professional gambler. Ruby's name was found on a list of professional gamblers in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, which was in the possession of professional gambler Harry Seedband when he was arrested in 1959. Additionally, the Dallas Police Criminal Intelligence Division listed Ruby and McWillie as being connected with professional gamblers. And we know that Ruby was involved in gambling his entire adult life. So why then did Ruby lie to the FBI about his gambling interest? And why would McWillie ask Ruby to come to visit him in Cuba right after the new military dictator Fidel Castro took over if Ruby didn't like gambling and had no other reason to be there? What about this idea that Ruby visited Santos Traficante in prison? On June 9, 1959, Fidel Castro ordered Traficante to be held at Trescornia, a comfortable prison camp in Havana. Traficante was being held because he had been a Fulgencio Batista collaborator and also a drug trafficker. At Trescornia, Traficante shared a cell with Lauren Hall, one of the men who would later come forward as having visited Sylvia Odio, only to later recant his story. A few years after the murders of Sam Giancana and Johnny Rosselli, the HSCA questioned Louis McWillie about Traficante, who was still alive at the time. At first, McWillie acted, quote, as if he did not even recognize the name. Later, McWillie said of Traficante, quote, he knew who I was, and he shook hands with me when he saw me, but that was it. McWillie said that he did visit the prison where Traficante was held one or two times, and that he saw Traficante there, but he was going to visit someone else. McWillie did not remember if Jack Ruby was in Cuba with him when he went to the prison. It was possible, but McWillie did not remember. 4 days after President Kennedy's assassination, British journalist John William Hudson contacted the U.S. State Department in London and said he was imprisoned at Trescornia in Cuba with, quote, an American gangster type named Santos in 1959. Hudson added, quote, an individual named Ruby would come to the prison with the person bringing food to Traficante. Santos Traficante himself told the HSCA, quote, I never remember meeting Jack Ruby. There was no reason for this man to visit me. I have never seen this man before. I have never been to Dallas. I never had no contact with him. I don't see why he was going to come and visit me. When asked about the allegations of fellow detainee John William Hudson, Traficante told the HSCA that he did not remember the man. On the other hand, a confidential source told the committee that Traficante did recall Hudson and described him as, quote, a kook, a funny guy, a mental case. Another prisoner, Jose Verdasia, also recalled a British journalist at Trescornia Prison. In summary, everyone agrees that in 1959, Jack Ruby went to Cuba to visit his close friend, who was as mobbed up as you can be, Louis McWillie. McWillie has changing stories about why exactly he wanted Ruby to come to Cuba, and McWillie admits going to the prison where Traficante was and even seeing Traficante there, and says it is possible that Ruby was with him. Now, I couldn't find any evidence that established that Ruby actually got Traficante out of prison. But looking at the official story, it seems quite possible that Ruby did go to visit Trafficante at Trescornia, especially considering that his travel records say that he was in Cuba from August 8th through September 11th of 1959, and Trafficante was in the Cuban prison from June 6th until August 18th. So Jack Ruby was extremely close to Louis McWillie, who was an associate of several major mafia figures. But given that Dallas was in Carlos Marcello's territory, did Ruby have any links with Marcello? From episode 83, we know that Joe Civello and Joe Campisi were Marcello's underbosses in Dallas. Did Ruby know either of them? FBI informant Bobby Jean Moore worked for Joe Civello as a clerk in his Italian importing company and suspected that narcotics were being shipped in because he was told to not open certain packages, even though that was his job. Moore said that Jack Ruby was, quote, a frequent visitor and associate of Civello. Ruby also knew the Campisi brothers well. He used to hang out in the Egyptian Lounge restaurant for hours. After the assassination, Ruby's roommate, George Senator, testified that Joe Campisi was, quote, one of Ruby's three closest friends. The same thing was acknowledged by Ruby's sister, Eva Grant, who told investigators that her brother spent a great deal of time in the Egyptian Lounge. Perhaps most telling, Joe Campisi met with Jack Ruby the night before Kennedy was assassinated, and he was the first person to visit Ruby in jail after Ruby shot Oswald. Campisi visited Ruby in jail again on November 30th. Further, Ruby also likely knew Carlos Marcello's brothers, Sammy and Vincent, through his slot machine and jukebox vendor, the Jefferson Music Company. According to what Marcello told Jack Van Lanningham, the ties to Marcello were even more direct than that. Marcello told him that his organization controlled the Carousel Club and that Ruby was just the manager. Marcello also relayed that Ruby had been skimming money that was supposed to be paid to him. According to Van Lanningham, Marcello summoned Ruby to his Churchill Farms estate to confront him about stealing money. Marcello said that Ruby begged for his life and said he would do anything to avoid the penalty of death. The author who's done the most work on the Camtex FBI prison sting, Lamar Waldron, believes that the favor Marcello called in to Ruby was for him to kill Lee Harvey Oswald. Confidence shouldn't be complicated. Through HIMSS, you can skip the guesswork and get access to care that actually fits your lifestyle. Straightforward, stress-free, and designed around you. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. HIMSS brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. This isn't a one-size-fits-all care that forgets you in the waiting room. It's your health and your goals put first with real medical providers making sure that you get what you need to get results. To get simple online access to personalized, affordable care for ED, hair loss, weight loss, and more, visit HIMSS.com/JFK. That's HIMSS.com/JFK for your free online visit. HIMSS.com/JFK. Actual price will depend on product and subscription plan. Featured products include compounded drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. See website for details, restrictions, and importance. If you listen to Solving JFK a lot, you know that I like to keep the vibes up. And that's why I'm a fan of federally legal cannabis from Mood.com. It's a brand that uses small organic farms to source its pesticide-free legal weed. You can get 20% off of your first order at Mood.com by using code JFK. My favorite product of theirs is the functional THC gummies. Usually I go with Epic Euphoria, but I also like Magic Mind and the Pure Relief CBD gummies. These legal weed gummies take about 20 minutes to kick in, and you can control the dosage yourself. Unlike the federal government, Mood.com has never sold drugs to fund illegal wars or clandestine missions. Thanks, Mood.com. So try out some of the excellent legal cannabis products from Mood.com and get a 20% discount off of your first order using code JFK. When Warren Commission staff attorneys Burt Griffin and Leon Hubert recommended to the commission that an in-depth analysis of all of Jack Ruby's phone calls in the months leading up to the assassination was necessary, Chief Counsel J. Lee Rankin declined to provide them with the resources they needed because he thought it would be too time-consuming. Luckily, the HSCA would later analyze Ruby's 1963 phone calls in an effort to determine if Ruby really was involved with organized crime. Of the five different business and personal phone lines Ruby used, the HSCA found that there was a significant increase in the number of calls Ruby made in October and November of 1963. The HSCA found that Ruby called the following people. He called Carousel Club financier Ralph Paul with exceeding frequency, as many as five times in one day. Between June and August, Ruby called Louis McWillie seven times. On October 26, 1963, Ruby called Irwin Weiner, who the HSCA referred to as, quote, a prominent underworld bondsman who was closely associated with Jimmy Hoffa and Sam Giancana, among others. Columnist Jack Anderson called Weiner, quote, the underworld's major financial figure in the Midwest. Weiner refused to cooperate with the FBI after the assassination when they questioned him about Jack Ruby's phone call. On October 30th, 1963, Ruby called Marcello Lieutenant Nofio Pecora at the trailer park he operated. The phone call only lasted 1 minute. Pecora denied knowing Ruby and said that Ruby must have been calling for someone at the trailer park. Ruby did know Harold Tannenbaum, a Marcello-associated nightclub operator in New Orleans, who lived at Pecora's trailer park and who called Ruby back the same day. Ruby made some 18 calls to Tannenbaum between May and November. On November 7th, Ruby received a collect call from Jimmy Hoffa's right-hand man, Barney Baker, which lasted 17 minutes. The next day, Ruby called Dusty Miller, another close associate of Hoffa and other organized crime figures. Other phone calls not highlighted in the HSCA report include several calls to Frank Caracci, a mid-level Marcello operative who was also close with Savello and Campisi. Ruby met with Caracci in person at least once during this period. Moreover, Ruby called Carlos Marcello's brother, nightclub operator Pete Marcello, twice between June and October and visited him in person once. Paul, McWillie, Weiner, Miller, and Baker all said that the subject of their phone calls with Ruby was Ruby asking for help with the American Guild of Variety Artists Union, which represented exotic dancers who Ruby needed to hire for the Carousel Club. Ruby began to notice that his competitor, Barney Weinstein, was getting around paying the full union wages to his dancers by using an amateur night ploy. Ruby's complaint was that he was having to pay more to union dancers while Weinstein was getting away with paying amateurs less money. Ruby tried to compete and do his own amateur nights, but they weren't successful. It then became Ruby's mission to get the American Guild of Variety Artists to either ban amateur nights or enforce the rules more harshly against his competitor. So what was really going on here? On one hand, there was a real issue that Ruby had with the American Guild of Variety Artists. All of the people who reiterated the union story were connected with organized crime in some way, but many of them were also affiliated with unions. Thus, there probably was some truth to the idea that Ruby was calling about a union issue. On the other hand, when the HSCA diagrammed the increase in overall call volume as compared to the calls purportedly related to the union issues, the union calls were less than a tenth of the overall increase in call volume. From April to September of 1963, the most long-distance calls that Ruby made in a month was about 40. However, in October, Ruby made about 85 calls, and in the first 3.5 weeks of November, he made 115 calls. Of the 115 November calls, only about 10 of them were related to the union dispute. So Ruby's issue with the Variety Artists Union alone does not explain the huge increase in call volume, especially in November. The thing is, we wouldn't expect any of the people Ruby called to say anything other than Ruby was calling about the union when they were questioned about it by authorities. If there was more than just the union issues being discussed, telling a different story would potentially implicate mafia higher-ups and put the witnesses' lives in danger. According to FBI reports, Jack Ruby was in Las Vegas the weekend before President Kennedy was assassinated. Sheriff Ralph Lamb said that a, quote, very reliable source told him that Ruby was at the Tropicana Hotel on Saturday, November 16th, and was hosted by part owner Preston Feinberg. In addition to the sheriff's anonymous source, an unnamed FBI informant who worked at the Tropicana also said that Ruby stayed there on Saturday, November 16th. The FBI report says, quote, she is certain that a Jack Ruby was registered at the hotel because she personally checked out his telephone account for the front office when he checked out. She is unable to explain how the hotel records of Jack Ruby have disappeared. That same FBI report says that another anonymous informant said that two of his co-workers at the Tropicana, Ernie Muscatelli and a bellman named Chuck, told him that Jack Ruby had been there that weekend. An informant named Hamer told the FBI that Ruby played golf at the Tropicana with Feinberg on the weekend of November 17th. Ruby gave his card with the name of his club to his golf caddy. Hamer said that Ruby often brought strippers from the Carousel Club to the Tropicana. Another informant claimed that Ruby was a longtime friend of Preston Feinberg, and he frequently visited Feinberg at the Tropicana. When the FBI interviewed Preston Feinberg, he denied even knowing Jack Ruby. We don't know with certainty that Jack Ruby was in Las Vegas that weekend. If all of these informants were telling the truth and Feinberg was not, then what was Ruby doing in Vegas the weekend before the assassination, and why was his presence there a secret? Some researchers have speculated that the Las Vegas trip could somehow be related to Ruby killing Oswald. After all, Ruby owed about $44,000 to the IRS at the time of Oswald's murder. Assuming he went to Vegas in the first place, after Ruby returned to Dallas on November 19th, he told his tax attorney that he had a connection that was going to supply him with the money to settle his tax debts. In 2019, author Tom O'Neill published a book called Chaos: Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s. In that book, O'Neill reviewed MKUltra documents with a focus on one of the program's top practitioners, Dr. Louis Jolyon West. So what exactly was MKUltra? Buckle up. It's one of those things that would be hard to believe if it were not definitively proven. In the 1950s, the CIA began to experiment on humans with lysergic acid dithylamide, better known as LSD. The experiments began with prisoners and people on military bases who were not aware that they were being drugged. During the Korean War, captured American pilots admitted on Korean radio that they sprayed the countryside with biological weapons. This made the CIA believe that the pilots must have been drugged. When those pilots returned to the States, they were sent to be deprogrammed. The lead psychiatrist who launched his career into the upper tier of the CIA by successfully getting those pilots to renounce their admissions about using bioweapons was Dr. Louis Jolyon West, better known simply as Jolly West. West began to increasingly work with Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, a poison expert who headed the chemical division of the CIA's technical services staff. In April of 1953, Gottlieb set Project MKUltra into motion. The goal of MKUltra was mind control, including, among other things, implanting false memories and removing true ones without a subject's awareness. The project was so secret that even CIA Director John McCone was not aware of it. In 1973, then-CIA Director Richard Helms ordered Sidney Gottlieb to destroy all MKUltra files. In their haste to shred documents, the CIA apparently forgot about 16,000 additional files in an off-site warehouse. The existence of MKUltra became public knowledge in December of 1974 when journalist Seymour Hersh broke a story about it on the front page of the New York Times. MKUltra did a lot of terrible things. Just one example is the story of Army bacteriologist Frank Olson. Olson was surreptitiously given too much LSD, which resulted in him breaking through a high-story window and plummeting to his death. It remains unknown whether Olson jumped out of the window or he was thrown through it. President Gerald Ford and CIA Director William Colby later apologized for Olson's death, and his family was paid a large settlement. The fact that Jolly West was working directly with Sidney Gottlieb on MKUltra has been established by the letters between West and a Dr. Sherman Grifford, which was Gottlieb's alias. Gottlieb wrote to West that he approved of him relocating to Oklahoma University so that he could become the head of the psychiatry department there. Gottlieb said, quote, "It appears at the moment to be a move which would in the long run be beneficial for us, presumably because there would be a constant supply of college students to run experiments on." In further support of the idea that Jolly West had CIA ties, when West accidentally overdosed an elephant with LSD at the Oklahoma City Zoo in 1962, the zoo was compensated by the CIA. Indeed, Jolly West had a top-secret clearance with CIA throughout his career. That CIA relationship is exactly what makes the actions of Dr. West, as related to Jack Ruby, so suspicious. After Ruby killed Oswald, West first approached Judge Joe Brown, who oversaw the grand jury, about being appointed to Ruby's case. Judge Brown rejected Jolly West's offer to get involved. West later noted in his internal papers that he had been asked to intervene in Ruby's case, but he didn't say by whom. After Ruby was convicted of murdering Oswald at trial, he brought in attorney and psychiatrist Hubert Smith to represent him on appeal. It was Smith who then invited Jolly West to conduct a new psychiatric examination of Jack Ruby. Incidentally, West then helped Smith to secure a teaching position at Oklahoma University. On April 26, 1964, Jolly West visited with Jack Ruby in the Dallas County Jail for the first time. On that evening, it was reported in the Dallas papers that West said that Ruby had undergone, quote, an acute psychotic break sometime during the preceding 48 hours. West added that Ruby, quote, was now positively insane. After the date of Jolly West's first examination with Ruby, every doctor who examined Ruby agreed with West's diagnosis that Ruby was now delusional. This was in stark contrast to the six doctors who saw Ruby before Jolly West did. All of them found Ruby to be sane. Judge Brown, who likely remembered West's earlier efforts to insert himself into the case, had some concerns about the sudden change in Ruby's mental state. He said, quote, I would like some real disinterested doctors to examine Ruby for my own benefit. I want to get the truth out of it. The doctor Judge Brown brought in for another opinion, Dr. William Beavers, confirmed Jolly West's prognosis of a psychotic break, but added, quote, the possibility of a toxic psychosis, i.e. poisoning, could be entertained, but is considered unlikely because of the protected situation. Perhaps Beavers would have had a different perspective if he knew West's background. About 6 weeks after he saw Jolly West, Jack Ruby testified in front of Earl Warren and Gerald Ford at the Dallas County Jail. During that testimony, Ruby was all over the place, including accusing his attorneys of working against him and constantly asking to be given a lie detector test and to be taken to Washington, where he said he could tell the truth. In summary, after being denied by Judge Brown, Jolly West still made it on Team Ruby, which implies that the CIA mind control doctor really wanted to be on the case. Jack Ruby's mental health is fine by all accounts until Jolly West visits with him, and then suddenly, immediately after Jolly West's visit, Ruby has a psychotic break. It appears highly likely that Dr. Jolion West used some technique, drugging or otherwise, to cause Jack Ruby to have a psychotic break. After all, that's what Jolly West did for a living. When Tom O'Neill asked Dr. Jay Shirley, a close friend of Jolly West who worked with him for 45 years, if he thought West would have accepted an assignment from the CIA to scramble Jack Ruby's mind, Dr. Shirley responded, quote, I feel sort of disloyal to Jolly's memory, but I have to be honest with you. My gut feeling would be, yes, he would be capable of that. If the president asked him to do something or somebody in a higher office, he would break his back to do that without asking too many questions. Incidentally, on the day after Timothy McVeigh's arraignment for the Oklahoma City bombing, McVeigh was examined at Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma by none other than Dr. Louis Jolion West. Next time on Solving JFK, we'll be off for a week before coming back for a bonus episode on Dorothy Kilgallen, followed by recap and rebuttals episodes for the Mafia and Jack Ruby. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.
In cybersecurity, speed isn't just an advantage, it's survival. SOC Radar is your early warning system against hackers. SOC Radar continuously monitors the external threat landscape, so cyber threats hit your radar before they hit your business. But it doesn't stop there. SOC Radar empowers your company with proactive exposure management, actionable insights that help you stay ahead of cyber criminals and minimize business impact. And with SOC Radar's holistic exposure management, you get complete visibility, attack surface monitoring, dark web monitoring, threat intelligence, and brand protection are all unified in one powerful platform. SOC Radar isn't just another tool. It's your frontline defense in a world where threats never sleep. Start your free trial at socradar.io/podcast. That's socradar.io/podcast. Don't wait.